Hello. Congratulations for making it through the day. It's the last session of the day, huh? I know. So I just sent someone. So apparently there was some, mistake in the app. This session was tagged as E1 as opposed to E7. I hope you all are coming to the right session here. So we're going to talk about big app workloads on Azure. Oracle, SAP, and many more. I know the title said Oracle and SAP, but since then, we've had more information. My name is Madan Aramugam. I'm a program manager in Azure Compute, and I have with me Brian Benz. He's a senior tech evangelist in Microsoft OpenTech. Without further ado, I'll get into the session, and then I'll hand over to Brian, who will deep dive into Oracle. All right, so first of all, let me get on the light. First of all, what do we mean by big workloads? Well, the title says big, In our mind, when we say big, it typically ends up being line of business, mission critical applications. There used to be a time, this was a deja vu conversation, when virtualization came into picture in the IT landscape. There was a time like 5-6 years ago, folks would say, no, I can't run my mission critical apps there. I can't run my database applications there. I very clearly remember those days. And then a couple of years passed by, and a majority of the applications started running within a virtual machine, whether it's Hyper-V or VMware. And, we are expecting something of that sort to happen with public cloud as well. Clearly, we're not there, but we are already seeing a whole bunch of mission-critical and line-of-business applications move to public cloud, including Azure, if you will. So, line-of-business, mission-critical, and I'll define that, more crisply. And they typically tend to be database applications or data workloads, analytic workloads, anything that does require a lot of compute, a lot of, data processing capabilities. And then, I would say last but not the least, kind of like batch HPC type applications, right? The reason I think these applications are nicely suited for cloud is just because of the economies of scale, right? Cloud is pay as you go. So there is this ability to kind of burst in as you need and then burst out. And typically when we talk about these big workloads, there are four dimensions we think about. Manageability, and I'll kind of go through each of these dimensions, but manageability, scalability, availability, and security. These are very important. I mean, if you take any line of business application, whether it's running on-premises, Oracle, SAP, SQL Server, or on Azure or AWS or GCE, these characteristics don't go away. I mean, you bet your business on this. They are typically IT managed. These are not one of those applications that you kind of like put it under your server or your data center and forget about it. They're typically, payroll applications of considerable business impact that, you have IT and operations manage them. So when you think about manageability, there is a whole set of, characteristics and attributes around deployment automation, right? Anytime you do updates, anytime you do patching or rollover, anytime you create a new environment for development, testing, and staging, there's a whole set of infrastructure requirements that you need to worry about. Oracle or SAP or IBM, it doesn't matter. Any of these big workloads require that. The next aspect of it is the ability to kind of, do deep integration and monitoring of the entire application lifecycle management, right? It's not just deployment of the applications, but, going through, setting up availability, setting through, maintenance, and then, the archival of it eventually, if you will. And last but not least, you don't want to give up on your existing tools, right? There's a lot of infrastructure depending on which investments you made. If you're a VMware shop, vCenter and vSphere, there's a whole bunch of automation infrastructure that you want to kind of continue to work in spite of your move to cloud. And that's certainly true for Azure. And when you think about scalability, most of these applications, because they are so demanding, they require huge scale-up machines, and in some cases, scale-out machines, like Oracle, right? So they typically are very high in terms of their CPU, memory, and I/O consumption, and those requirements don't change because you're moving to cloud. A lot of these applications have a long history of benchmarks, right? Oracle, SQL Server, IBM, DB2, and again, the first thing folks consider when they are evaluating a particular cloud platform is how is it running? How does it compare to my actual machines on-prem? They want to get to the lower level details of the specs, of the VM that it's running on. and also standards, right? Like, you know, specific, you know, benchmarks have standards, you know, for databases. We have the TPC organization. A lot of those still apply here. And last but not the least, best practices, right? You know, there's volumes and volumes of this literature available. It's not like, you know, suddenly one day you're going to throw out. A lot of that you're expecting to carry over because it is the same personnel that is managing it. It's just the deployment happens to be in two different environments. And when you think about availability, when we define mission-critical applications, we define it in terms of recovery time objective. This is the time, the mean time between failure. Say you have a downtime, and then you know you have some period where you're actually turning around, and then you have a downtime and an uptime again, right? So that mean time between failure is the recovery time objective, or RTO, that typically ends up being 3 nines or above. 3 nines totals to about 8 hours a year. And the same thing for data loss, which is the recovery point objective. Again, you know, how much data are you losing between, you know, the two uptimes, if you will. And again, the typical, when you say mission critical line of business, it tends to be 3 nines again as well. And of course, disaster recovery, these are your, you know, business critical applications. You know, you want to have a strategy around if something strikes, you know, within that region, do you have a, you know, a disaster recovery site, you know, 100 miles away or more than 100 miles away. And last but not the least, this is cloud after all. You know, you're not giving up your data privacy and protection characteristics, so you want to make sure that whoever you're choosing as your cloud platform, you know, satisfies all the compliance. So how many of you are running or evaluating Oracle, SAP, IBM sort of workloads in the cloud? Doesn't matter where. Okay. So clearly, there is appetite for it. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to kind of start out with is, you know, so big workloads means big partnerships. Some of these partnerships are so big that, you know, it's a new story in the history of Microsoft, even like Microsoft and Oracle, who would have thought, right? You know, especially in the database world, there's so much competition and we continue to compete with them. But on Azure, it's a completely different ballgame because for any public cloud provider to succeed, we have to be able to support both Microsoft's own first-party workloads as well as third-party workloads, whether it's open source or proprietary. They have to, you know, run well. Because the reality is that you go to any shop, you know, any IT shop, it's not a perfect, you know, I'm all Windows or all Linux. It's a mix of Windows and Linux. It's not all Oracle or all SQL or all DB2. It's a mix of all of these, right? We've known this for a while, but obviously in aspiring to be the premium cloud provider, we have to make sure that, you know, we don't have second class citizens, right? You know, just because, you know, it's not a database product from Microsoft doesn't mean that it should run any less. So again, this is just emphasizing the fact that, you know, we are partnering with some of the biggest names in the industry, you know, when you define, you know, the mission critical applications. And, you know, we made an announcement just a few days ago, you know, in collaborating with IBM. And again, you know, you'll see more details come through it. Brian will share a bit more information on this. And again, you know, we are excited about the partnership here in terms of what, you know, Azure will be able to provide to IBM customers and vice versa. All right, so I wanted to kind of give a kind of high-level framing around how we would talk about, you know, the rest of the session. So when we think about, you know, moving applications, such big applications like Oracle and SAP to Azure, there are a few application patterns that are common. People are doing that for a variety of reasons, but there are four reasons that resonate, right? If you think about the first one is the most easiest to start. Look, you know, I've got cloud, it's cheap, it's pay as you use, even the licensing is per minute. You know, it takes me even, you know, I just spin up a VM, you know, run SQL or Oracle for like, you know, a couple of hours and then I can shut it down, right? So there is this really nice appeal for agility. It's all pre-built, pre-configured. I don't have to go talk to my operations team to kind of set up the server, set up the environment, have the policy figured out. I can just spin it up, try out something, tear it down, right? So that's a very, very low barrier for entry for someone to go, you know, develop and test your applications in the cloud. And the graphic here is simply saying that, right? Like there is this promise of compatibility. Whatever I try, you know, I should be able to kind of bring it back on-prem, you know, once I'm done with, you know, my dev test in cloud. The second pattern I would say is around lifting and shifting. So once you kind of do the development and back, you know, you're getting comfortable with the homogeneity of the environment, right? You know you have certain guarantees that you can rely on. It's a VHD, is a VHD, is a VHD, right? So as long as it's packaged in the right format, you should be able to kind of move back and forth. So there is portability there. The next, you know, scenario or the pattern, I would say, is just extending, you know, your infrastructure. And there's typically two reasons. One, for disaster recovery. And the easiest of the disaster recovery steps is I just want to take a backup. I'm not like, you know, trying this fancy, you know, active or active passive, but, you know, just a backup. I want a place to store my backups, you know, my database backup fuel or my entire VM backups. It's in a safe place, it's away, it's cheap, and when I need it, I can restore it back, right? And then the progression of that is where folks would actually have, you know, like an online application that's spanning, right? You know, you have a set of secondaries sitting on your, on, you know, in your private data center, and it's domain joined to a set of VMs in Azure, and they are essentially running your secondaries, and they happen to be active. You can do, you know, readable secondaries, you know, backup from secondaries, and so forth. And then the next progression of that would be true bursting. I'm like, you know, load balancing back and forth, right? So that's an advanced form of, you know, extending your infrastructure. And then the last application pattern, I would say, is the cloud scale, right? So once you get to a point where you're comfortable not just running in one region, and for a cloud provider like Azure, which has the most regions across the world, you can then think about, hey, maybe I'll have, you know, a set of secondaries in Dublin and a set of secondaries in Europe, you know, basically the two pair regions in Europe, if you will, right? And then I can, you know, orchestrate some interesting load balancing or even potentially, you know, failover, you know, to a particular region when there is a demand there, right? So there is interesting cloud scale applications and development that you could do, if you will. So you would see as we walk through some of the considerations we have for Oracle and SAP and IBM, you know, we'll actually walk through, you know, the four dimensions as well as these four scenarios. How many of you have actually used Azure Infrastructure as a Service? Okay, so there is a bit of familiarity. So I'll just, it's just a one slide. I wanted to kind of set context on some of the best practices that we will give. So, you know, the terms are not, you know, foreign to you. So at the highest level, it's just a VM, right? It's a virtual machine. You get to control what's running in it. We do have a set of gallery pre-built images, whether it's Oracle or SQL or DB2 or even OSS varieties that you can just click and deploy, you know, really fast. But you can bring your own. You can package it up. You can install your proprietary software. You can bring your license. Nothing stops you from doing that. And then it basically our cloud is running hypervisor, you know, the Windows Server Hyper-V, and then you essentially are creating virtual machines on top of them, right? And every virtual machine, if you open the hood, you will see an OS disk, you will see a temporary drive, and then you can optionally add a bunch of data disks, right? So this is the basic structure. And you can see, you know, the disks are essentially backed by our blob storage. So every disk, every write that you make, we make three copies. So by default, they are durable, right? So you don't have to worry about data loss when you do writes to your OS disk or data disk, if you will. So this is at a very, very high level, a simplistic picture of what you get when you go create a virtual machine. And this is essentially the pulled out view, if you will, right? So in essence, Azure as a data, you know, infrastructure is composed of 19 regions. Each region is built up with a bunch of data centers, and each data center has what we know as clusters. These are essentially a bunch of racks. They typically come in 20 racks or 40 racks or 80 racks. And each rack have a bunch of machines, right? Like typically 40 to 80 machines. And your virtual machine is literally running in one of them, right? And if you're creating a highly available virtual machine, you're spreading them across, you know, different what we call as fault domains, right? So if this whole rack, you know, fails, you know, you have some high availability. So this is kind of like the two ends of the spectrum, your view, which is a bunch of virtual machines, and the physical view, which is the Azure footprint, if you will. All right, so at this point, I'll hand over to Brian so he can kind of, you know, go through those, that framing in terms of what it means for Oracle. Brian?
Hi. So, Brian Benz from Microsoft Open Technologies. So we are a group of developers. We're actually a wholly owned subsidiary of Microsoft, and we have three parts. We have engineering, which helps make technologies work the best they can on our cloud platform, Azure. And then we have standards, which we have a lot of people who are standards professionals who spend all day making sure that Microsoft products work with the latest standards and that the latest standards work with Microsoft products. I'm part of the evangelism group, and we spread the word about all the work that the other guys do. We take credit, basically, for all the work they do. So, I just want to say thanks for coming this afternoon as well. Just before, about 15 minutes before the session started, there was nobody in this room. We were going, uh-oh, we have an Oracle session at Tech Ed. So I'm glad you guys showed up. So thank you for that. What I want to talk about, just a little bit about Oracle. We're the people who helped negotiate the Oracle deal. And I'll talk about the IBM deal, actually, as well after this, because it's related. But we have Oracle images that are certified on Azure. And what that means is they are supported. They're supported by Microsoft and or Oracle. And I'll explain what the different cases are for those later. So who here uses Oracle on-premise? Oracle database, actually, specifically. Okay, and what about WebLogic? Okay, just a few, all right. Java developers or admins, okay. Just a few of those as well. And how many people here are looking to move Oracle workloads or big data workloads to the cloud? Okay, cool. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And how many people are here for SAP? How many people want to know about SAP? All right, a few more. So Matt is going to talk about that in a little while, but I'll go through the Oracle part for now. So our images include Java, Oracle WebLogic Server, Oracle Database, Oracle Linux as well. Let me just switch over here. I'm going to show you, if I go into the dashboard here, and I say new, and virtual machine from gallery, and you can see here we have several items. First of all, there's all the usual Microsoft items. We also have some Linux images here. The ones that we're going to talk about today are the Oracle images. So we have several Oracle images. These are all most of them are based on Windows, and a few of them are based on Linux, Oracle Linux. The difference between those is the Windows versions of these are license included, meaning in the price there is a bundled add-on that includes the license that you pay for by the minute. And the other images are bring your own license images. So if you have a license, you have excess capacity in your licenses in your enterprise, you can actually load up the Linux images and you manage your own licenses for those. So those are two different options. And let me go back to the slides. All right, so the difference between these, these are the different options you have, actually. You can build your own VM and bring your own license for that VM. So if you have Oracle licenses, this is a great situation for people who have Azure credits and they have Oracle licenses that they're not using. They can put them up on Azure, use your Azure credits for the compute and storage, and then use the license in the cloud. You can also bring your own license, and you can use a pre-configured VM, and those are the Linux images that I showed you earlier, not the Windows images. But if you wanted to run Windows, you can set up your own VM using Windows and run it with your own Oracle versions. Or you can use one of our license-included VM images. And the licensing considerations, the idea here, I guess, the license-included images are more expensive than if you bring your own license in general. Normally, you have a negotiation that you've made with Oracle. Your licenses are at a special price, whereas our licenses are full price. So, but when would you want to use those? Well, if you have a situation where you're trying to roll something out to the cloud or you're migrating. We had a customer who's merging two companies and they just needed a place to put these things. They didn't want to buy a server. They just temporarily put these things so they could do some work, merge data and run some analysis on that data and then shut it down when they were done. So short-term sort of uses or year-end, if you have a retail operation that at the year-end you have a big spike in traffic, you can just fire up one of our servers without having to go to Oracle, negotiate licenses, and go that route. Azure support costs are per customer. That's one important consideration, whereas the Oracle support is per license as well. We actually provide support for our Windows included images. We have a team of people on 24 hours who manage those for us through Azure support. So good fits for license included, as I mentioned, the dev test environments, backups, your company's merging, you just need a server for a while, and then you're going to shut it down afterwards, and moving things to production. Good fits for bring your own license, you already have some extra licenses and you have some Azure credits or not, you just want to move. Also, if you're migrating off unsupported hypervisors, older versions of Oracle, things like that. So I do want to talk a little bit about WebLogic Server. Just a sec here. So WebLogic Server itself, one of the things I want to show you, actually this is a good time for the demo. So just to give you an idea of the kinds of things you can do with Azure. Yeah. So I put together a really quick little demo here. And this demo is, you guys might have seen this before, it's a WebLogic demo called Dizzy World. It's multiple nodes, and I'll show you what it's made up of in a second. But if you notice this line up here, when I refresh the screen, it's changing different nodes, 1 to 3. I don't know what happened to 2. Hey. But it's changing 1 to 3, just showing that we've got multiple nodes in the background that the traffics are being managed through this on. So how this is built is, if I go in here and look at my virtual machines, I've got one admin server here. And this is just a Azure virtual machine, a relatively small one, 2 cores. Then I've got 3 nodes. And I've got a cloud service over here as well. Let me see that cloud service. Where is it? Well, it's cluster. And this cloud service is basically aggregating all of these nodes together. If you look over here on the right, you can see the input endpoints right there. So what we've done here, and this is actually pretty cool. I don't know about you guys, but I've been around in the software business for a long time. I remember having to ship my own 2 laptops around to show server and client demos and do presentations like this with 2 laptops, and here's my server and here's my client. And I did this at the Orly Airport yesterday, and I set it up in Western Europe. And I just want to take a moment to say how amazing that is that I could do that. Just sitting in the airport firing up 6 servers or so, making them all work together. It's kind of cool. But anyway, I thought it was neat. So anyway, we've got this configuration here, which is multiple servers, multiple nodes. They're all connecting together. If we actually go into the WebLogic server itself, I'll show you the servers. There's just 3 servers and an admin server. So the admin server is determining which server the traffic that's coming in is going to be pointing to. And I've set up a cluster inside of WebLogic. And it's a round robin cluster. So in this case, round robin just means that whatever traffic comes in, if one of the other servers is overloaded, in this case they're not really overloaded, but if one of the other servers is overloaded, it's just going to go to the next server. So that's why you see the switching there. So it's pretty cool. I mean, you can set up these multiple servers like this fairly easily. And what we've done in this particular case is we've set up an affinity group of all the servers. And what that does, let me show you a picture just to show you the idea here. So this is an Azure data center. You can see here the actual data center itself. Inside that data center is a pile of servers. So when I set up one of those, when I'm sitting in the Orly Airport and I'm setting up one of those servers, it's actually going out to Western US, or Western Europe in this case. And it basically sprays those servers around in this data center here, all over the place. If you set up an affinity group, that tells Azure, oh, these servers, I want them all to be close together so you get better performance. So that's just some of an idea of the kind of options you have for this. So instead of putting, you know, one server here and then one server way at the back, it's going to put them all in the same rack, basically, and they'll be able to perform better together. So what I've done is I've set up virtual machines. I've got three cores. I've got three Azure storage items as well. So the Azure storage is actually connecting to the virtual machines in this data center and serving up my data. And that is how that works. Let me go back to the slide. So some of the considerations when you work with WebLogic. The JDKs are 64-bit. They have to be 64-bit. If you're using the older versions of Java with 32-bit hardware right now, you'll have to upgrade to 64-bit. So there's some considerations there. You've got dynamic clusters for easy provision and management. That's the clusters I just showed you there. You can grow the WebLogic clusters, and if you put them all in the affinity groups like I showed you, then you can actually have them all close together for better performance. By the way, the reason why Azure sprays them all over the place is for disaster recovery and backup. So when I define where I'm going to put these servers, I put them in Western Europe. And Western Europe is a region. That means that there's not a specific location. There's actually multiple physical locations of the different buildings where these machines could be. And inside each one of those buildings, there are multiple physical locations where you can put the data. And that's just so if there's an outage, a fire, any kind of disaster like that, that things will be safely covered. UDP multicasting is not supported. That's one of the things we need to mention. And IPv6 support in WebLogic Server, if you're using that, doesn't work. You can't load balance multiple instances of WebLogic servers in a single VM. That's why I used multiple VMs for that. So migrating. Let's talk a little bit about migrating. Mountain touched on this a little bit. But basically, converting physical servers or virtual machines on other platforms, running Oracle to virtual machines on Azure. So you have your physical server. You can actually migrate these. You know, if it's hosted somewhere else, Amazon, or it has a VMware image. The idea here is take those virtual instances and move them to Hyper-Vs. And once you have them on Hyper-V, you can package them up and send them out to Azure. If you have huge mega workloads, we have a service. What is that service called? I can't remember.
It's called Migration Accelerator.
Not that one. There's another service we have where you can actually, if you have terabytes of data.
Import-export.
Import-export, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Couldn't remember for a second there. But you can actually put it on a hard drive and ship it to us, and we will put it in our data center and load it up. Instead of having to download, upload terabytes of data, we can do that. We also have this other tool called Migration Accelerator. I'll show you in a minute, which speeds up this process by helping you orchestrate. So the idea here is you take your virtual instances from any Hyper-V instance to any other Hyper-V instance. Could be in your data center, it could be in a virtual cloud at your location, or it could be on the cloud on Azure as well. So new cloud deployment options as well. You could extend Windows Server, of course, migrate off unsupported hypervisors. And the idea here is, as I mentioned before, dev test is a really good scenario for using this for WebLogic, Oracle, DB2 as well. I'll show you DB2 in a minute. Key considerations for Oracle databases. The number one on the bottom there is Oracle Rack. We don't have support for Oracle Rack yet, and that's the clustering that provided by Oracle. We do have Traffic Manager, and we have some clustering capabilities built into Azure, but if your application relies on Oracle Rack, we don't have that. We do have DataGuard and Golden Gate. Those are two application performance enhancements that we do work with. Virtual networking, such as Traffic Manager and things like that, helps with VPN connectivity. We do have some disk limitations, which actually might be raised based on the new capabilities that we've advertised. But we don't have SSD storage yet. We do have SSD compute, which is nice. As soon as we have SSD storage, I'm pretty sure this will be a limitation that we can remove. I do want to talk a little bit about Java on Azure. So we have different options for Java on Azure. IaaS, we have Windows or Linux VMs. I showed you the images on Azure that we have, Windows or Linux. We have the Oracle JDK, V6, V7, and V8 actually now. Pre-configured VMs. We have WebLogic, as you just saw. We've got VM Depot. Has anyone heard of VM Depot before? Okay, this is a good one to know. So if you're using virtual machines, MS OpenTech has built a marketplace. VM Depot, MS OpenTech. There we go. This is a marketplace of applications. They're all based on Linux. They're all free. And they're packaged in Hyper-V. You can download these images. And you can put them on a local cloud. If you have, you run them anywhere the Hyper-V runs, on Azure and on the cloud. Thanks. And the idea here is, for example, we have Jenkins, popular continuous integration software server. If I click on Jenkins here, so what happens is if you want to set up your own Jenkins virtual machine, you have to configure Java, Jenkins, and Tomcat. You have to install all that software, then you have to make it work together and test it. We've already done that. So you can just take this package. It's free. You have to pay for the compute and the storage if you're using that, of course. But you can take these packages and load them up on Hyper-V. It takes minutes to get up and running with those. And how you do that, there's two different ways, actually. You can click here in vmdepot.msopentech.com, and there's select a region. Let's go with West Europe. What this does is creates a script for you that you can use as a template to deploy this using the CLI. How many people are familiar with the CLI here? PowerShell, I'm sure most people are familiar with. But the CLI itself, the command line interface, just a couple of people, it's a Node.js-based multi-platform command line interface that we've built. It's based on, as I mentioned, Node.js. And you can download it from Azure. There's a new way, though, as well. And what happens is when you download that, you set up Node.js. It runs on Mac, Linux, and Windows, of course. But once you've set that up, you can control deployments and other things from Azure. I'm sorry, from a local client out to Azure. And if we go to the new portal as well, there are VM Depot images actually in the portal. Did I miss it? No, it's down below. VM Depot, community images. So this is even easier now. If I do a search up here on Jenkins. Jenkins, so there's the same image we were looking at. Now I just have to say create. And it's actually going to, I fill out this little form here, and it's actually going to create that Jenkins image for me from the VM Depot image that we have. You can also publish your own VM Depot images if you want to. Anything that works on Hyper-V, you can publish out and put it on VM Depot. It's free to do so. So just a little bit about that. So talking about Java then, so I talked about the VM Depot image. so PaaS. PaaS is our, so IaaS is our virtual machines, regular servers. PaaS is our cloud service, runs on Windows, and we manage the operating system for you instead of you having to manage your own operating system on the virtual machines. We have a 64-bit OpenJDK. It's built by Zulu, by Azul, and it's called Zulu. Azul is the company is the corporate custodian of the OpenJDK JDK. And we also built an Eclipse plugin. For if anyone's using Eclipse for development, we have a plugin that will actually allow you to create a cloud deployment package And what that means is you can, inside of Eclipse, test your applications on an Azure emulator using this cloud deployment package. And when you're ready, with a one-button click, you can publish out to the cloud, to an Azure cloud service. We also have Java websites. So Java websites is in the web gallery. And we have the option of running Tomcat or Jetty and a couple of different JDKs. The idea here is if you want to build something in IaaS or PaaS, actually specifically PaaS, you can develop that iteratively using Eclipse generally or IntelliJ or something like that. You can publish those packages out to virtual machines. But if you just have a WAR file like Jenkins, Jenkins is a great example. If you have a WAR file that you just want to deploy out and get running without actually doing any development or having any IDE involved, you can use our Java websites to do that. So you go to the websites gallery. That's where we keep WordPress, Joomla, Drupal, things like this. One of the options is Tomcat. You can set up a Tomcat server, throw Jenkins on it, fire it up, and all of a sudden you've got a continuous integration server for your team, and you don't have to buy a server or any software for it. So those are the three options for Java. So as I mentioned before, we've been working with Azul Systems, and we have a OpenJDK. It's a Windows-optimized version of the OpenJDK that we've been working with Azul to build. We also, of course, have WebLogic, and we have cloud services with Tomcat and the Eclipse plugin that I mentioned before. So we do have quite a few Java customers now. Java, people don't really necessarily associate Java with Microsoft, but a lot of developers and enterprises use Windows as their client for development. They have Eclipse running in Windows. And a lot of applications, I know a lot of IBM, I used to work for IBM, a lot of IBM applications themselves have a Windows flavor. Some of their ETL tools and MDM tools, data analytics, things like that, and they're running on Windows Server in big enterprises. So these are just some of the examples. Went too far there. So how does support work? As I mentioned before, so bring your own license for Oracle. Is supported directly by Oracle, of course. Obviously, if you have any issues with Azure, we'll work through them specifically, but if you have any issues with Oracle Database, WebLogic, things like that, if you brought your own license, you talk to Oracle about that. Our license-included images, you talk to Microsoft. Microsoft support is where you go. Azure support, we work with them to resolve any issues with our Windows images. We've tested them. They're certified by Oracle on Azure, and we've been working with them for a long time. So anybody go to Oracle Open World this year? It was in September. Nobody. Okay. One of the big announcements we had at Oracle Open World this year was IFS. They're a third-party provider of enterprise software, and they actually run all of their software as a service on Azure now. So we have 100% of their customers running on Azure. It's Java, and it's based on Oracle products, Oracle WebLogic and Oracle Database. Redney is another service provider, and we work with them as well to provide their software as a service offerings on Azure. This thing on. There we go. We have a lot of documentation. If you just search on Oracle on Azure, you'll come up with this page, and we have all kinds of instructions on creating Oracle WebLogic server clusters. The one that I just showed you, there's a how-to on building that, how to build a Java application server on a virtual machine, and several other documentation options there. Oh, yeah, breaking news. So breaking news, IBM, and this just came out last Wednesday. We have negotiated with IBM. Let's see here. Let's do a search on IBM and the virtual machines. And these are just out as of this morning. So we have an IBM DB2, too much coffee, Advanced Workgroup Edition. We have WebSphere, and we have IBM WebSphere MQ. Those three are available. And we have a third party, Lieberman Software, has a random password generator for DB2, which they contain the word IBM, so it's showing up in the results. But these three images are there, DB2, WebSphere, and MQ. Now, what else is included? I think it's this one. Okay, so those are the images that we have, similar to the Oracle images. If you want to use other flavors of DB2, WebSphere, and MQ, that's okay too. Here's some of the products that are available. DB2 Advanced Workgroup Server, and these are under the Bring Your Own License. So the images that I just showed you are license included, similar to the Oracle Windows images. They're only running on Windows. But if you wanted to run these on Linux, you can run those as well. So DB2 Enterprise Server, WebSphere Application Server Liberty, and a few other products. There's some links we'll send at the end of the presentation that you can follow these as well. But this is out on IBM's website, and they've published these as endorsed images that you can use with Bring Your Own License on Azure. So that's just a little bit about IBM's offerings on Azure. Pay as you go, and I'll hand it over to Madden for SAP.
All right. Thanks, Brian. So in just continuing with the theme on the Oracle and the IBM for SAP, this is what we have today. If you think about what is supported today, or I should say today things are changing, but if you go into the documentation, the set of products that we support, definitely SAP Business Suite, anything that's based on NetWeaver, right? NetWeaver 7.x. And then SAP HANA, the developer edition is supported through the SAP Cloud Appliance Library. How many of you use the SAP Cal? This is basically the SAP's cloud portal that, they support the single sign-on and, they support Azure as a backend as well. So HANA is supported through that. So to yesterday, the VM, the only VM size that you can run on Azure for SAP applications was A5, which is a fairly small VM. In terms of resources, right? It's basically, I think, 8 cores or 4 cores and then, 14 gigs of RAM. So just yesterday, we announced support for higher VM sizes. And by that, we literally mean now you can run, production SAP systems on Azure. And the table essentially changes to, what you see here, right? The VM sizes, now suddenly we have about, half a dozen, and some of them are our high memory and the SSD-based systems. And as part of announcing the support, we also announced the benchmark results of SAP 2-tier and 3-tier configurations running on Azure. I have links to both the SAP nodes and the Microsoft nodes with all that information. This is exciting because there's already a lot of customers running SAP systems on Azure, either for development test or even for production. There is this one U.S. company, it's the fourth largest U.S. company, auditing company, and they have literally hundreds and hundreds of SAP systems running on Azure. And we have several such customers, and opening this up now officially means SAP will actually also support it, as opposed to just, they're doing it on their own, if you will. I won't go into details, but these are kind of like the high-level benchmark results that was published yesterday. And you can see clearly the D14, which is our largest VM with 112 gigs of RAM and also a whole bunch of SSD space. You get up to like 18,600 SAPs. And this is a two-tier configuration. What that means is the application server and the database is running in a VM, and then the test harness is running in another VM. And then the three-tier configuration, which is the classic SAP benchmark, where the app server and the database is in two separate VMs. With running 10 A7 VMs, we are able to get up to 50,000 SAPs, if you will. The key aspect around running SAP system on Azure is you need to have the SAP support contract or the Microsoft Premier support contract, just like you would have for Oracle. And unlike Oracle, today we don't have pre-configured SAP images in the Azure gallery that Brian showed. This is something that we are working with SAP. In near future, we will have, click to deploy software for SAP. Today, your option is to go through the SAP Cloud Appliance Library to kind of have a click to deploy software. So when you think about SAP, obviously, they're a three-tier application. There are two major categories of topologies that we support. First is what they what we classify as hybrid, and these are essentially an application topology that spans your private data center and Azure, and they are connected through a secure virtual private network, right? So either you're using a site-to-site virtual network, a VPN, or Express Cloud, which is our high bandwidth connectivity between your data center and Azure. And what that really means is the application is domain joined, right? Regardless of whether it's running in Azure or on-prem, it's a single Windows domain that is connecting all of this, the entire application. And what from a SAP landscape or the SAP application point of view, it doesn't know that there are certain virtual machines that are running in Azure and certain that are running in on-premises. And this configuration is fully supported. Non-production, production, it doesn't matter. Especially with us supporting the higher VM sizes, we are supporting all sort of production workloads in this topology. Now, the second category of topology is what we call as fully contained in Azure, but it is not using, it is connecting to some assets, especially data sources that are on-prem, but it is not connecting through a virtual private network, which means you're going directly through public internet. Now, that topology is only supported for SAP demo or sandbox systems or training systems. It is not meant for production systems. So this is something that, obviously SAP is very particular about. There is a slight caveat here. There are folks who, think about all the variations in this topology. So I kind of put together some picture. So this is what a typical non-domain joined topology looks like. So you have a bunch of these on-premises virtual machines, you have a bunch of SAP systems, and then you're going over the public wire, right? So this is unprotected. You can use HTTPS, but still you have an endpoint that is exposed publicly in the internet. And then you're accessing a bunch of SAP footprint here as well. Like I said, this is not typical for production systems. The VMs are not part of the same Windows domain, if you will. The one that is supported for production systems, as I mentioned, is the domain joined topology. And you can see, even though it's going from your data center to the internet, the fact that it is going through a site-to-site or express route, it means that, it's complete. It's a trust boundary that, nobody from, outside of the internet can, peer into. And from a SAP application landscape point of view, it just doesn't look, any different than what you run on-prem. There is obviously latencies involved in terms of what you place on-prem versus Azure. And this is where the earlier point that Brian mentioned. So there is this notion of affinity group, which is really placement. Like, do you want to keep the application server and the database server close together, or do you want to keep them separate for disaster recovery reasons, right? And so talking about that, when you think about the application server and the database server, what is supported is, keeping them together. What is not supported is you keep, the database layer in Azure and the application server. So for obvious reasons, you will have performance impact, you will have kind of like availability and disaster recovery impact as well. So what are your options? You want to get started. Now, this is kind of the support document, if you will, right? What's supported, what's not supported. So just like Oracle, your options are you start from an Azure VM gallery where we support Windows and database images, whether it's Oracle or SQL. And obviously, you want a database, so you can start there, and then you can install the SAP components. The Windows and the SQL images are license included. They are per minute. And then the SAP licenses, you would bring from on-prem, right? So that's one path. We have a lot of customers who are using that. Almost the same reasons as what Brian mentioned for Oracle, right? And I have excess licenses, SAP licenses lying around, but I want to kind of get started quickly so I can start from an image in the gallery. The other option, obviously, is you already have your systems running on-premises. You just package them as VHDs and ship them to Azure, very similar to the Oracle. And the third option is, like I said, is the SAP Cloud Appliance Library, which supports multiple cloud platforms, including Azure. So you go through that, SAP has a single sign-on process. You don't even leave SAP's portal experience. You wouldn't even know. You just choose an option, say, Azure, and then the Azure features just, show up there. And SAP HANA today is supported in SAP Cloud Appliance Library. It's only supported through SAP Cloud Appliance Library. So if you're, trying out SAP HANA, that's your only choice. All right, so what are the considerations? So one of the things, and this is common, whether it's SAP or Oracle or IBM, like obviously the first thing you want to find out is there are so many VM sizes. How do you start, right? You need to first figure out if the application that is running on-premises, will it fit, you know, what is the right VM that you want to choose in Azure, right? You know, you have VMs with SSDs, you have VMs with high compute, we have VMs with InfiniBand, we have VMs with memory. So you want to kind of form a resource profile of your VMs based on the number of virtual CPUs, memory, networking requirements, number of disks that you can mount. You know, all these are specific limits that, you know, every cloud provider, obviously Azure as well, have, right? So and I have a link to that here. We have a document that describes the total number of IOPS you can get from a storage account, which is today 20,000 IOPS. With the premium storage, you can get upwards of, you know, 60,000 IOPS, right? And per VM, you can have up to 16 terabytes today. And with premium storage, you will get 32 terabytes. So all these limits have to be factored in when you think about just migrating an application. So you want to kind of do some sort of a resource profiling and capacity planning. The other thing that you would probably have to do is also, because of the layout of the volumes, the data disk volumes that you have in Azure, and I'll quickly show you an example. Because these are backed by Azure Blob Store, there are a bunch of storage considerations you need to have. How to place these data files? Do they all go into the same storage account, or do they keep it in multiple storage accounts? And I'll go that into a little bit more detail. So really, these are the three questions you want to ask, right? Does your single largest, you know, functional component of your SAP application, can it fit into a VM? And what VM size would that be? And, you know, if you have a specific, you know, a resource, whether it's CPU, memory, disk I/O, these typically tend to be the, you know, the most resource-intensive aspect of a SAP subsystem. Make sure that, you know, it can fit within the different sizes of VM that we have. And then the third point is really around high availability. Right, most of these systems, right, in Oracle or IBM or SAP, these are mission-critical systems. You know, they are clustered. Either, you know, they have high availability configurations on top of them. So you want to make sure that you are getting the same experience, application experience on Azure as well. And I'll go into a bit more detail there. So the one, and I can, instead of showing the text here, I can quickly show you. So one of the considerations that you need to have, this is six. If you open up an Azure virtual machine, you'll see that, and I have an example here. This is basically, I created a SQL Server Enterprise 2014 image. You know, this is what I would start from there, and I would install the SAP system. And you can see I have a 3 terabyte log disk. You know, I have this is my OS disk, and then I have about a 12 terabyte data disk, if you will, right? Now, you'll notice that my OS disk is only 127 gigs, right? It's not terabyte. So this is a specific characteristic of the Azure platform that you want to make sure that when you're moving applications from on-premises, you're not putting all your data on the OS disk. If you do, then you'd have to move it to a separate data disk, if you will. So this is the VM that I just created. Now, if you go into the portal, and if you look at that VM, you'd see that it actually claims that there is about one OS disk and 16 data disks. So what I have done here is I have actually created a Windows Stripe set on top of the data disk, so which is why it looks like I have a 12 terabyte data disk and then again a 2 terabyte log disk, if you will, right? And these files are pretty simple to go see. If you, for example, if you go here into a storage service, you would be able to kind of see, let's see, cloud servers, and if I go to my storage servers, you'll see that all of these VHDs are some things that you can just explore. Well, it's coming up. Yeah, and you'll see this is my storage account, and if I go look in the dashboard, and if I look in my containers, under VHDs, you'll see, you know, all the data disks that I created, you know, they actually show up here. So literally every one of the data disks that you're creating within the VM are backed by our Azure Blob service. So if I go back, so the key consideration is the size of the OS disk. If you want to keep your database in Azure VM, you want to make sure that your log and your data files are, log and the data files are actually in two separate drives. The D drive that comes with an Azure VM is a temporary drive, so make sure that if you are putting some information into that drive, that you are careful about what you're putting. We recently changed the recommendation for our D series because they are SSD based, so you get a lot more price performance that way. And then the last thing that you want to keep in most database systems, don't do, you know, buffered writes, and that is the recommendation that we have for our data disks running in Azure VM as well. Let me move along. So this is just the graphic of the same information that I had. So you will see you basically have the OS drive that is backed by Azure Blob Storage. Like I said, this is limited to 127 gigs. You can create a bunch of these data disks like I showed in the VM. I have 16 of them, 16 terabytes. And then, you know, what I had done was basically create a single stripe server. In fact, in my case, I had created two drives, one for data, one for log, because I was running SQL Server. Storage considerations. This is a very important point, and I would imagine whether it's Oracle or IBM or DB2, you would need to kind of think about that. Today, the maximum number of storage accounts that you can create per subscription is 100, which is actually quite a large number. But each storage account can only serve 20,000 IOPS. A lot of these business critical, mission critical applications, their IOPS requirements far exceed 20,000 IOPS. So there will be a situation where you would have to kind of span multiple storage accounts, right? Because on premises you're probably running behind a SAN or some big storage volume of some kind, right? So here is the link that I mentioned earlier. This has all the limits that you have in the Azure platform. Almost every cloud provider has this documentation. So I would highly recommend you folks to take a look at it before you decide how you're going to size it. Do not create, like for the same VM, do not create disks in two different storage accounts, because that essentially creates an uneven performance profile. So you want to make sure that every VM is mapped to a storage account. And if you do have needs for more than 20,000 IOPS, then the best opportunity you have is to wait for the premium storage, right? And networking considerations. So this is, these are mission-critical applications. They don't like a public endpoint that is exposed in the internet. Even if you ACL them, folks are not comfortable showing your, database endpoint, publicly visible in the internet. So what you could do is you could do two things. One, today in Azure, you have the ability to support public IP address reservation and then ACL them. So that's one option. SAP actually officially supported that a week back. And then you can also do internal load balancing, where you're not exposing the public virtual IP address, but you still want your, for example, your app server or your database server. If you want load balancing, you could do that. Again, the link here is actually the official blog from SAP folks having tested, and they are now supporting it. Availability considerations. So Brian mentioned about the affinity group. So the way you want to think about that is, anytime you have a topology that is spanning more than multi-VMs, there are two policies that you want to think about: affinity and anti-affinity. Affinity is where you're saying my application server and database server, they are chatty, I want to keep them together as close as possible, right? Because that's what you do on-premises. So, you don't like incur latencies. The anti-affinity is where, like say you have a DR topology, an application, a front-end, an application server, a database server, front-end application server, database server. Obviously, you don't want to co-locate them, because the whole point of that is if this fails, this is alive, right? So we have both those concepts modeled in Azure. When you want to co-locate, use an affinity group. When you don't want them to co-locate, you can create a separate storage account in separate regions, right? Typically, our regions come in pairs. So if it's Amsterdam, then it's Dublin. You can choose which is primary for you based on where your business is running. Azure, one key important process here is Azure today doesn't support shared storage configuration, just like what Brian was mentioning for Oracle. One of the reasons we don't support RAC, Oracle RAC. Similarly, SAP systems have this single point of failure with their SAP service, actually the ASCS service, and that requires clustering. So today, the only option you have is basically using third-party solutions. We are considering, like Azure Files. I don't know how many of you used Azure Files. It's a SMB implementation on top of Azure Files. This is currently in preview. We are hoping to be able to support clustering implementation on top of that, and this is something that we'll continue to work on.
But we hear that there is a new product called Image.
Yes.
It's Microsoft acquired
Oh.
Yeah, Microsoft InMarge or Microsoft Accelerator is a slightly different product. What it does is it specializes in disaster recovery and migration by automatically doing replication.
Hey, Matt. Sorry, I put it up on screen.
So at this point, the focus of the product, and obviously that product InMarge supported both migration and disaster recovery. What you have out there already, and this is currently only available in the US, by the way. We are opening up to other geos, including Europe. Is focusing on migration. Our next step is to your point, integrate as part of Azure Site Recovery, which is our disaster recovery operation, also used in March. But even in that case, like configurations like Oracle RAC or SAP, you know, SAP's actual process, those systems need to support in March. So it's not one of those things where we can agnostically implement a solution on top of it. And this is where I think we have to work with both these companies to make sure. You know, maybe they say, you know what, I want shared storage, and which means we have to implement clustering support on top of the Azure platform. And like I mentioned, Azure Files today provides, you know, a path forward in terms of being able to support shared storage implementation. It's just not supported yet, you know, because the service is still in preview. If you go back to slides quickly, yep. Brian. Just a couple more things that I want to touch on. Backup and restore, you know, typically, you know, the database backup and restore policies you should be able to kind of continuously use if you're using SQL Server. SQL Server has really native integration with storage. If you're using any Windows Server 2008 R2 or R12, you can just use the inbox solutions that we have. You know, that's no different. It's just Windows Server running in Azure as opposed to on-prem. Disaster recovery, again, the same thing, no different. The only caveat here is what we talked about, right? The shared storage implementation for the SAP CI. ASCS, SCS cluster configuration. Azure Storage does offer geo-replication, but that capability cannot be used for SAP because SAP, the Azure Storage replication capability doesn't give the control today to the customer to control, you know, what exact point in time you want a failover or, you know, basically also control synchronization between multiple blobs or multiple disks. So that is the reason we are saying it's not supported today. Azure monitoring, this was something that I wanted to kind of quickly show a demo. Just some quick context. So one of the key components that SAP systems running in Azure, in any time if they are NetWeaver based, is they have to have the Azure monitoring extension enabled. So Azure monitoring is a component that the Azure engineering team put together for supporting SAP systems. If you use the SAP Business Suite, they have a very rich UI that collects performance monitoring from whether it's running on a physical machine or a virtual machine. So one of the key requirements for your product to be supported by SAP and Microsoft is you are enabling this extension, and I'll quickly run through. At the highest level, all it does is there is a simple end-to-end UI that I'll show you that actually pick a VM, and it will actually enable this two components, which are essentially opening up the necessary performance counters for SAP host system to be able to consume and then show it in its own UI. So I'll quickly show you what this experience looks like. It is pretty simple. There is an end-to-end documentation view here. So you first go to this website. You just download this PowerShell module. It's actually an Azure Script Center. It's nothing fancy. You know, it's all open source. But if you look here, what I've done, if I go to my PowerShell, what I've done is I've imported that, right? I imported the module, and then I'm just going to run the, that script, and it basically asks. It asks for your Azure subscription information. In my case, I'm using my Microsoft subscription, and then if you're using your org account, you just sign in. And then you'll see quickly. If you see sign in, the script uses that information, understands what your subscription controls, and you'll quickly see in my subscription, in my account, obviously, I have a bunch of subscriptions. So what it asks me is which subscription that I'm supposed to use. And I say, You know, I'm using one of the subscriptions that I use for testing the SAP systems. And then it's basically looking through my subscription and understanding, you know, what VMs are available. And as you can see, the VM that I showed you, the SQL EE 2014, I have that and I have an SAP system. So for the demo, I'll choose the SAP system. It basically goes and deploys the necessary components and then, looks into the storage account that is connected to the virtual machine, opens up the metrics collection, and then starts collecting that data back to your storage account. And then there is a process that runs within the virtual machine which reads those tables and then passes it to the SAP account host process, which then shows up in the UI, right? So this is basically a pretty a neat integration that the customer don't have to worry about. It's all done for you. And then, as soon as you fire up the SAP system, it should show up. So anytime you have a SAP issue on Azure and you're calling SAP support, this will be the first thing that they'll ask. Do you have the monitoring information? Without this, they won't have the ability to kind of help you and troubleshoot you. It's something that is critical. So just make sure if you're running SAP on Azure, you'll see this. But anyway, I'll let this run through in another couple of minutes. The VM will have the monitoring system enabled. All right.
Oh, that's my screen.
Oh, that's your screen. Okay.
So. Actually, I wanted to tell you, if I don't mind, just let me jump in for a second here while we're here. So if anybody wants to know more about deployment scenarios from on-premise to the cloud, Thursday, the same time, myself and Luis Carlos Vargas Herring will be having a session on deployment scenarios specifically, and I'll be drilling down into the WebLogic server demo that I showed you to talk a little bit more about how that was actually deployed, the PowerShell scripts and things like that. So, a little plug there.
Yeah, I used to be in the SQL Server team, and so it's a really good session. All right, so if I keep going, so case studies, just like what Brian talked about, so these are some known case studies of customers running SAP systems on Azure. SET is actually an Australian firm that deals with transportation stuff. They use Azure as their disaster recovery, so they actually have a parallel three-tier stack, SAP system stack, that actually runs on Azure. They didn't want to kind of spin up an additional data center, so they have an entire SAP farm, if you will, that is stood up on Azure. And this is about to be published in a week. Microsoft IT, obviously Microsoft IT is a big user of SAP itself with SQL as a backend. And we have hundreds of SAP systems, the three-tier systems that are currently being migrated to Azure. And then the auditing company that I mentioned that I didn't have the information yet, but this is something that we'll publish as well. So really quickly wrapping up this section, so the key reasons why customers use SAP systems running on Azure, there's a lot of value that they get in being able to, provision 200 to 300 times faster, right? Spinning up VMs on Azure is so fast. You saw that for Oracle. You saw that for SAP as well. And then the development and test. The key feature of being able to shut down the VMs when you don't need and not pay for them is of super interest for a lot of companies, right? Like they don't want to kind of keep the dev and the test systems running forever. So being able to rapidly deploy and shut down is a key value proposition. And then the training scenario. A lot of the sales force in these companies typically create their sandbox proof of concept systems to kind of prove that things are working, right? Like it's a continuation of the development test, but it's slightly different. So you can package it like what Brian was saying. Before you had to kind of haul around a bunch of laptops and a bunch of machines, now no longer, right? You can just throw it up in the cloud. And last but not the least, you can archive them. When you don't need them, it's all in Azure. You can resurrect them, and you're just paying for the storage cost, which is pretty cheap. We have a similar page for SAP, on Azure. Almost all the documentation is right here. We keep them pretty up to date. And you can see here, right? So you have Oracle here, you have SAP, and pretty soon we'll have IBM there as well. So what's coming from a SAP on Azure point of view? The new G-Series, which is the largest VM at this point in any public cloud provider, as soon as it is available, we'll support for SAP, and I would imagine for Oracle as well. Premium storage, absolutely, right? So these are database systems, mission-critical systems. You'll only be able to get more and more performance there. Azure is in 16 regions, including China. One of the things that SAP Systems will pretty soon support is deployment in Azure China. So these are some of the things that are coming. Oracle and RAC support in China, do you know, Brian?
I'm sorry, what was that? Oracle?
Oracle RAC support.
Or Oracle RAC support. Yes, there are some things that we're... So the question was, are we eventually planning to support Oracle RAC? A question we get often, and yes, we are. It's something that we are working on implementing. I don't have a specific date, but there's several workarounds we have to do for Oracle on Azure that makes it work with our Azure platform. It's just a little bit of a challenge, but we're getting there. Eventually, it will be there, though. I mean, we get a lot of demand for that. So, most applications use RAC. So, yeah, yeah, okay.
Sorry, sir, can you repeat the question? It is the whole platform, and if you refer back and you'll get access to the slides, we have the grainy details of what are the different versions of, you know, the entire stack that will be supported. Yeah, it's meant to be there. For example, if it's, you know, the business one, it's the entire stack. You know, NetWeaver backend, the database backend, and in fact, our documentation goes into a fair degree of detail there. This is the last section there. I want Brian to kind of quickly finish, our other partners.
Oh, yes. Okay. So I'm going to go through this really quick because we just have a few minutes. But we do have our HD Insight Hadoop implementation, and they have a actually Hortonworks has a booth here if you want to see them more about that. And we actually have something in the Azure section as well talking about HD Insight. So it's our Hadoop solution. We really have been participating with, or Microsoft has been participating with, Hadoop and the Hadoop ecosystem and the community. We've actually contributed back 30,000 lines of code for the Hadoop core. We have several implementations and several add-ons to use besides just regular Hadoop. So anybody who's working with Java, anybody who's working with workloads on Oracle or Big Data generally is at least looking at Hadoop, if not using it already. So we support Hive. So HD Insight automatically out of the box supports Hive. So it allows you to do SQLite queries on Hadoop. We also support HBase. So allowing you to have NoSQL type functionality, API calls into Hadoop as well. And access to MongoDB, CouchDB, things like that. HD Insight also supports Mahout, which is the machine learning capabilities. These are all built into the Hortonworks offering, the HD Insight offering that we have on Azure built in. Literally, just click in the Azure portal, you fire up an HD Insight application, and you have all this available to you. Storm as well, which is real-time analytics as well. We also support our group, Microsoft Open Technologies, has been working with MongoLab, MongoDB, and Cloudant. So MongoLab is a service provider that provides the community edition of MongoDB as supported software as a service. MongoDB itself is the company who's the corporate custodian of MongoDB. They have a version called the enterprise version. So the community one is the free version. The enterprise version you pay for, but it's supported by MongoDB themselves. It includes this thing called MMS, which is MongoDB's management service, allows automatic backups and several other features, and it's actually just more performant. And we have Cloudant. Cloudant is CouchDB as a service as well, and you can find those all through the Azure portal. So a few resources here. I won't go through any of these. Do you want to cover any of these? Or?
Yeah, no, I mean, you will get this. I mean, there's plenty of resources, documentation, you'll see at the end of the slide.
So we just have a minute left.
Yeah, and we'll try, you know, stay around. You know, definitely give us feedback in terms of the session itself, the content, whether it was useful. If you want to see something different, something more, you know, give us feedback. But yeah, we'll be hanging around here if you have any specific questions.
Yeah, and please do fill out an evaluation form. These are very important to us, especially with new technologies like this. We need to know what you came for, if we met your needs or not, and what we could do better for the next round. We're really kind of shooting in the dark to figure out who's using Oracle, who's using SAP, and what they're looking to use it for on Azure and things like that. So much appreciated. Yes? The question was, can you use standalone Golden Gate?
Rack
to standalone Oracle. No, I don't. I mean, we just don't support Rack right now, just because of some of the things. It takes over a lot of the operating system fabric that we have on Azure, and there's conflicts with it. So if it's not in multiple. If we're not using it for clustering, it probably won't work for standalone either, unfortunately. It will work. I mean, Golden Gate does work. We've tested Golden Gate by itself without any sort of rack component, and it does work. So, okay. You could try it. That's all I can say. See if it'll work. But no guarantees on that one. Sorry. Any other questions? There's no other session coming in here, so if you guys have more questions, you know, take your time. Unless you want to get to the expo hall, get some food and drinks.
So. All right, well, thank you so much for hanging out here. I know it's the last session of the day, first day. It's probably a long day for you all. But thanks for coming.